Worldwide, cardiovascular disease affects the lives of hundreds of millions. Dedicated cardio nerds everywhere are working hard to fight this global epidemic. These are their stories.
Welcome back, Cardio Nerds family. We have another exciting episode as part of our Cardio Oncology series. Today, we are thrilled to discuss the important topic of cardiotoxicity of novel immunotherapies. As part of the Cardio Nerds case report series, we have discussed an interesting case of immune checkpoint inhibitor, ICI for the cool kids, associated myocarditis. And that's on episode 196, so definitely check it out. But now we're going to go deeper into this very important topic and also discuss other cardiotoxicities related to immunotherapy. Without further ado, I'll kick this off by introducing our team. We are thrilled to have our FIT lead, Dr. Evelyn Song, who is a cardiology fellow at UCSF and a CardioNerds Academy faculty member who is interested in advanced heart failure and cardio-oncology. Evelyn, welcome.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for that introduction. It's such a pleasure to be part of this cardio-oncology episode and introduce one of our CardioNerds cardio-oncology series co-chairs, Dr. Giselle Suero, who is a cardiology fellow at Massachusetts General Hospital with a longstanding clinical and research interest in cardio-oncology.
I am so excited for the opportunity to co-chair this series and to share my passion for cardio-oncology with all you cardio nerds. Special thanks to my cardio-onc colleague, Evelyn, for this introduction and for her role in helping us draft this episode together. It's great to be joining all of you tonight and learning from a leader in the field of cardio-oncology as our guest expert, Dr. Thomas Nealon. Dr. Nealon is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, the director of the cardio-oncology program, and co-director of the Cardiovascular Imaging Research Center at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. He's also the Michael and Catherine Park Endowed Chair in Cardiology at the same institution. He has been part of several original research publications related to the cardiotoxicity of cancer immunotherapy. Welcome to CardioNerds, Dr. Nealon.
Thanks for having me. It is a pleasure. While we're waiting for that leader to join us, I'm happy to answer any questions. I have been looking forward to this for quite a while, and I think it's going to be a fabulous show.
Thank you, Dr. Nealon. Thanks for joining us tonight. We're all super excited to discuss and learn more from you about this fast-growing field of immunotherapy and its associated cardiotoxicities. So before diving into a series of cases, let's learn more about immunotherapy, which has been a rapid growing cancer therapy in the recent years. So immunotherapy is a type of novel cancer therapy that leverages the body's own immune system to target cancer cells. Today, we will focus on the most common type of immunotherapy, immune checkpoint inhibitors, or ICI, as Dan said, what the cool kids call them. I understand that ICIs are monoclonal antibodies that target immune checkpoints or brakes to reduce negative signals or enhance positive signals and modulate T cell recognition against tumor antigens. Ultimately, this leads to a heightened immune response targeting the cancer cells. Currently, there are four main classes of FDA-approved ICIs, which are monoclonal antibodies blocking the cytotoxic T lymphocyte antigen 4 or CTL4, PD-1 or programmed cell death protein, LAG-3 or lymphocyte activation protein 3, and lastly, PD-L1 or programmed cell death ligand 1. Although other mechanisms are also currently in clinical use, these four are currently FDA approved. And these have become pillars in treating numerous malignancies. But we have learned that ICIs lead to nonspecific activation of the immune system and off-target adverse events affecting every organ. So Dr. Nealon, can you tell us more about why it is important to learn about the potential cardiotoxicities of immune checkpoint inhibitors?
I would be happy to. The first thing I ask is that you call me Tom, if that's okay with you.
Of course, will do.
So as you said, better than I could probably say, up to about one third of the current U.S. cancer population are eligible to receive an immune checkpoint inhibitor. It has indeed become one of the pillars of cancer care. There are over 100 different FDA approvals for immune checkpoint inhibitors. There are over 5,000 clinical trials ongoing at present where immune checkpoint inhibitors are being combined with traditional cytotoxic therapies, targeted therapies, with radiation treatment, with surgery, in people with late stage disease and people with where it's adjuvant or neoadjuvant expected to survive for many years. So the use of immune checkpoint inhibitors for cancer is only going to continue to increase as it has done exponentially over the last decades.
That's so interesting and so important to remember. And we can just go right ahead and dive into our first case. Our first patient is Ms. Melanie Anoma. She goes by Mel. And she's a 60-year-old woman with metastatic melanoma who was started on combination immunotherapy with nivolumab and ipilimumab 2 weeks ago. She's now presenting to the ED with chest pain, dyspnea on exertion, and fatigue. Tom, I want to point our Cardinals audience to check out the primer that was led by Dr. Lily San and was published in JACC CardioOnc last year, where your group and her describe the evolving landscape of immunotherapy and the clinical spectrum of the cardiac immune-related adverse events that are associated with ICI therapy. So can you share with us what are the most common ICI-related cardiac adverse events and which ones would you consider in this patient?
Thanks for giving a shout out to Dr. Zhang, or Lily, as I know her so well. She is the director of cardio-oncology now at Montefiore. She led that publication where we gave a brief overview of the toxicities and the landscape of immune checkpoint inhibitors. The way I would answer your question is relatively simply in that if there's a cardiovascular event that's associated or driven by excess inflammation or immune activation, then that cardiovascular event can be increased by the use of immune checkpoint inhibitors. And so the response to that statement is, but Tom, every cardiovascular event is driven by inflammation and immune activation. And therein lies the final answer. Every cardiovascular event can be increased by the use of immune checkpoint inhibitors. But what are the feared ones? The feared ones acutely, the main feared one is the development of myocarditis. Myocarditis with immune checkpoint inhibitors, the incidence is a little debated. First reports of myocarditis, first real substantive report was a case report in New England Journal back a couple of years ago. And they used a pharmacovigilance database. And in that, single agent therapy was far less than 0.1% and combination therapy, maybe 0.2 or 0.3%. But that was a pharmacovigilance database. And if you've ever looked at how these things get put into pharmacovigilance database, you can understand why that underestimated significantly the incidence. So what is the incidence of the most feared complication of myocarditis? And the best study is a New England Journal paper where patients with melanoma, relatively low cardiovascular risk population with melanoma, were randomized to one of two cohorts, nivolumab or nivolumab plus a LAG-3 inhibitor. And LAG-3 is one of these other immune checkpoints that Evelyn mentioned is just recently been FDA approved. And in the nivolumab group alone, they had an incidence of about 0.6 to 0.7% of myocarditis. And in the combination group, they had 1.6 to 1.7%. To stick a little bit of a step back, in that study, they only screened for myocarditis for the first couple of weeks. And so they probably missed the tail of myocarditis. So what you can take from that study in New England Journal is that the minimum we're seeing is about 0.7 to 1% incidence rate for single agent immunotherapy for myocarditis, and about 1.7 to 2% for combination with LAG-3 inhibitors. Still relatively an uncommon complication, but an absolutely feared complication because of the rates of major adverse cardiac events that occur in patients who developed myocarditis. So what are those rates of major adverse cardiac events and what are the major adverse cardiac events? We estimate that cardiac mortality alone in folks who get myocarditis from the immune checkpoint inhibitor is about 30%. And then when one combines serious things like complete heart block, ventricular tachycardia, cardiac arrest, cardiogenic shock, on top of that, you get to MACE rates or major adverse cardiac event rates, which are well over 50%. And 55% in most series. So it's an uncommon toxicity. It's typically an acute toxicity, which is what one would worry about in the case you presented, but it's associated with a very high rate of major adverse cardiac events. And that's why it is at the top of our differential.
This is so very helpful. And thanks for going through the myocarditis and then the associated cardiac pathologies that we could see associated with checkpoint inhibitors. So, and you sort of alluded to this already, but how does the timing of checkpoint inhibitors relate to the onset of the adverse events? Do you typically see the adverse events in the early phases of therapy, or is this something that we see early phase and also as the treatment course continues or even after treatment?
Great questions. So we think that most of the cases occur early, and data are a little variable, but actually not too variable. And we think that at least 80% of cases occur within the first 3 months. And so if you screen within the first 3 months, you'll pick up the vast majority of cases. So this patient that Giselle presented is right in that early 3 month period where our concern would be highest. Now, we do have 20% of cases that present after 3 months. And it's kind of a relatively interesting and evolving observation that most of the cases that present early present with EKG abnormalities, elevated troponin, real true acute myocarditis. In the tail presentation, the one that present after 3 months, we're seeing a slightly higher percentage of this non-inflammatory cardiomyopathy, patients just presenting with an EF reduction on immune checkpoint inhibitors. We understand that very little about this latter presentation, this non-inflammatory cardiomyopathy presentation. We are beginning to understand more and more about the acute presentation, the acute myocarditis with the fulminant presentation that we sadly sometimes see in our coronary care.
Thanks, Tom, for sharing. You know, as you mentioned earlier, ICIs have now become more prevalently used. And so I think it's very important for us to always keep that on the differential when we see someone coming in with cardiac manifestations if they're on immunotherapy. So let's move on with our patient. As initial labs were notable for elevated troponin and BNP with non-specific T-wave changes on ECG. Transthoracic echo showed a newly reduced EF of 40% without wall motion abnormalities. So common things being common, we always need to rule out acute ischemia in these patients given the troponin elevation and new reduced EF. And with the recent initiation of ICIs, the team was also concerned about ICI-associated myocarditis as a diagnosis of exclusion. So Tom, what is your approach to the diagnosis of ICI-associated myocarditis in this patient? And what is your framework to rule out other important conditions as acute ischemia? And is there a formal definition or diagnostic criteria that cardio nurse can use when encountering these patients?
Great questions. And so I might throw that back a little bit, Evelyn, to say, actually, myocarditis is diagnosis number 1, 2, 3, and 4 on the differential list. And do we come in patients with a classical presentation early after starting immunotherapy with a no clear ischemic presentation, not ischemic EKG, no chest pain, non-regional echocardiogram? A lot of us would say that do we truly need to exclude ischemia? And by going down this path of excluding ischemia, are we delaying the correct diagnosis here, which is myocarditis? And by delaying the correct diagnosis, are we delaying the correct treatment, which is holding the immunotherapy and starting corticosteroids? That's a longer conversation, but certainly the data would show that a delay in time to making the diagnosis of myocarditis and a delay in time to starting corticosteroids is associated with worse outcomes. But the typical presentation of individuals with myocarditis is early after starting immunotherapy with an elevated troponin. The vast majority, well over 90% have an elevated troponin, well over 60% have an elevated NT-proBNP. But only about 40% of patients with biopsy-proven myocarditis will have a reduction in left ventricular ejection fraction. So the more typical presentation we see is with a cardiac syndrome, elevated troponin, and preserved left ventricular ejection fraction. So what do I do with the average patient who presents where there's a concern for myocarditis? an echo standard first line test, everybody gets an echocardiogram in the assessment. Even if the ejection fraction is preserved, we don't use the preserved ejection fraction to walk away and say, this is not the diagnosis. We'll commonly ask our sonographers and our echocardiography colleagues to measure global longitudinal strain, because global longitudinal strain is typically reduced in patients with immune checkpoint inhibitor myocarditis. But none of those things make the diagnosis. And so how would you make the diagnosis? The first non-invasive test we would think about doing is a cardiac MRI. Cardiac MRI, as you know, is the gold standard imaging test for the diagnosis of myocarditis. And the things we'll ask our colleagues in cardiac radiology to look for is the presence of late gadolinium enhancement and the presence of edema. On MRI, we applied a modified Lake-Louise criteria, which have a non-ischemic myocardial injury component and an edema component. And what that simply means is we asked them to do late gadolinium enhancement. We asked them to do quantitative tissue characterization, measure T1. We look at qualitative edema and measure T2. And we put that all together and say, this looks like myocarditis or this does not look like myocarditis. Now, if your clinical index of suspicion is high enough, and despite a normal cardiac MRI, you'll go ahead and ask folks to do a endomyocardial biopsy, a native heart biopsy. So if your MRI is not diagnostic and you still have a high index of suspicion, which you should have in a patient presenting it exactly like this, then you ask your colleagues in interventional cardiology to go ahead to do a native heart biopsy. If your MRI is diagnostic, then you're done. You don't have to go any further. But if your MRI is non-diagnostic, then typically it's native heart biopsy. Patients who are too sick for a cardiac MRI, which is a reasonable percentage to cohort, we will go straight to endomyocardial biopsy. And of course, at the same time we're doing endomyocardial biopsy, because we're in the cath lab, we will often ask folks to exclude coronary artery disease by doing coronary angiogram. But even if there's bystander coronary disease, it's typically liver coronary disease that's causing this presentation. And so our standard approach is echocardiography, and then patient well enough for cardiac MRI will get an MRI. If the MRI is positive, then you have a diagnosis. If the MRI is negative and your index of suspicion remains high, then you'll ask for an endomyocardial biopsy. If the patient is too sick, then we'll go straight to endomyocardial biopsy. While we're in there, we'll ask for coronary angiography. And the good news is, as opposed to, there's a nice publication in the European Heart Journal led by Dr. Jörg Herrmann from the Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Herrmann published a table presenting diagnostic criteria for immune checkpoint inhibitor myocarditis, which are spread out roughly into what I said, which is you get to the diagnosis by looking at pathology, so endomyocardial biopsy, where you get to the diagnosis by having a clinical syndrome plus other stuff. And the clinical syndrome is elevated troponin. And the other stuff is you look at the echo, you look at the cardiac MRI, you look for other immune-related adverse events, you look at the EKG. That's my general approach.
Thinking of the point you made, Tom, about a prompt diagnosis in given that certain cardiomyomarkers, such as elevated troponins or new EKG changes, are very commonly part of the presentation and guide a diagnosis of ICI myocarditis, or maybe even other cardiac immune-related adverse events, should we be thinking of baseline cardiac tests before someone is started in an ICI? And if you agree that any baseline tests should be done, which patients should we be doing these on, and should we be even following them over time?
That the second part, Giselle, is a highly controversial question. The first part, I think, is far less controversial. And so the first part is, should we do some form of cardiac assessment prior to starting immune checkpoint inhibitor? And the answer is, for me, very straightforward. Every patient should have an EKG and a troponin performed at baseline prior to starting an immune checkpoint inhibitor. And the rationale for that is relatively straightforward. It's not that we would use that baseline EKG or baseline troponin as a reason not to give the immune checkpoint inhibitor, but we would use this as a reference standard, because a lot of these patients develop fatigue, develop nonspecific symptoms. And often what happens in these patients, they'll get a troponin check on therapy, and they won't have myocarditis, but they might have a detectable troponin. And it's just phenomenally useful to have that baseline assessment to do comparison. So that's why I will always advocate for baseline EKG and baseline troponin prior to starting immunotherapy in every patient. The second question was, should we do on-treatment surveillance among asymptomatic individuals getting immune therapy? And I think the answer is no, we should not. I think the studies that they've done that comprehensively, there's a nice paper by Dr. Brian Reaney in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, JCO, and they did this routine surveillance, including echocardiography, as part of a study called Javelin, I think. And they found no value to the routine measurement of troponin, EKGs, and ejection fraction in patients undergoing immunotherapy. So I don't advise anybody routinely gets these measures. Indeed, there's a nice study as well from Dr. Han Zhu and her colleagues at Stanford. The first author is Dr. Waliani. What they did was they serially measured troponin in a cohort of over 200 individuals getting immune checkpoint inhibitors. And when you talk to them, they were on the pager all the time answering pages about elevations in troponin. They ended up having about 12% of patients who had a detectable troponin on immune checkpoint inhibitors, but only 1.4% of those individuals ended up having myocarditis. So there was well over 10% of patients who get on immune checkpoint inhibitors when you do serial surveillance, and they'll have an elevated troponin that will not be myocarditis. And the concern here is that these patients will inappropriately get their immune checkpoint inhibitor held because of a rise in troponin, which is not myocarditis. So I typically do not advise any routine on-treatment surveillance, but every patient should have baseline tests. And those baseline tests, just to take that a little bit step further, I do not think should include an echocardiogram. Just an EKG and a troponin suffices.
Thank you, Tom. That was very helpful and really exciting to see all the active research done in cardio-oncology. And you mentioned earlier that even when cardiac MRI is negative, but our index of suspicion is high for myocarditis, we should proceed with heart biopsy. And I'm just curious, what's the sensitivity of cardiac MRI? And is there any role for other imaging modalities such as FDG PET before going for a biopsy?
Great question. So depends on your cardiac MRI. Let me say that. And so there are different approaches for the assessment of potential myocarditis on cardiac MRI. And so the standard approach many years ago was look for edema on black blood imaging and look for late gadolinium enhancement. If they're the only tools in your toolbox, along with left ventricular ejection fraction and pericardial effusions, then you're going to miss myocarditis in about 48 or 50% of cases with a preserved ejection fraction and about 25% of cases with a reduced ejection fraction. However, the world of cardiac MRI has moved beyond these qualitative approaches to more quantitative approaches. And the quantitative approaches are where we do T1 and T2 mapping. And if you're able to do T1 and T2 mapping along with late gadolinium enhancement and edema on black blood imaging, then the sensitivity and specificity of cardiac MRI increases dramatically. And you're quite unlikely, especially with the use of T1 mapping, to miss myocarditis. And so your second question, Evelyn, was what is the role of other modalities, including FDG PET? And that question is relatively easily answered. There is no value in doing FDG PET in these patients. There is a nice study, and I'm sadly blanking on the first author, which was published in 2021, where a group in France took a cohort of patients with suspected immune checkpoint inhibitor myocarditis. And the entire cohort was maybe 30 patients or so, or a little bit larger. And all patients underwent endomyocardial biopsy to prove or disprove the diagnosis. And all patients underwent an FDG PET. And there was no difference in FDG PET signal between those patients who subsequently had biopsy-proven myocarditis as compared to those individuals who had biopsy-excluded myocarditis. So we routinely do not advocate for FDG PET in patients for when the concern is immune checkpoint inhibitor myocarditis. Now, I want to take that a little bit step further. And that's not to say that there may be no value in PET-based approaches to this diagnosis, because there's some really exciting preclinical data suggesting that there may be a role for other PET-based tracers in the diagnosis of myocarditis. There is a nice study using a somatostatin-based tracer, which is a measure of edema. And there's also a nice study using FAP, or fibroblast activating protein, a measure of fibrosis, as a potential marker on PET for immune checkpoint inhibitor myocarditis. But those are not approved tracers, and they're early phase studies with small sample size.
Tom, what do we know so far about the pathophysiology of immune checkpoint inhibitor associated myocarditis? How do biopsy findings compare to other types of autoimmune mediated conditions such as giant cell myocarditis or transplant rejection?
So the latter is a really great question. And the reason why is it's pathologically almost identical to transplant rejection. And so what we'll often do is we'll say to our cardiopathologists, we'll say, "Doctor, I understand that this is not a transplant patient, but when you look at the endomyocardial biopsy, could you give us a grade as if it was transplant rejection?" And then we will take that grade and then use that grade to try and decide about intensity of immunosuppression. Now, as what the pathological drivers of myocarditis are, we really do not understand. There is a nice paper in New England Journal of Medicine which suggests maybe it's shared antigen between the tumors, between the cardiomyocytes, between the myocytes. That's certainly a possible theory. We have a limited understanding of the pathophysiology that drives immune checkpoint inhibitor myocarditis. This understanding needs to improve. And until very recently, our understanding was partially hampered by the lack of robust animal models to better understand the disease. And in 2020 or so, in Cancer Discovery, there was an elegant paper published which successfully recapitulated the phenotype, which is immune checkpoint inhibitor myocarditis, in a mouse model. And I think that will give us a better understanding. But before we get updated data from those mouse models, I think we're left with several possible theories for drivers. One of those theories is shared antigens across between the tumors, between the cardiomyocytes and muscles. There are other possible theories, and this is an evolving area.
Cardiologists are increasingly encountering these patients with ICI myocarditis on the front lines, and these numbers are just meant to increase. As we learned today, delay in diagnosis and treatment should be avoided. And these patients really present very sick, sometimes with acute heart failure, and they could quickly progress to either cardiogenic shock or life-threatening arrhythmias. Tom, you mentioned earlier some of the treatment strategies with corticosteroids. So can you tell us a little bit more about the initial management and the dosing for these patients?
Great question, Giselle. So first thing, non-pharmacologically, every patient with suspected immune checkpoint inhibitor myocarditis, where there's a reasonable index of suspicion, should be admitted to an acute care facility. And every patient should be admitted to an acute care facility whereby they can handle the potential complications of immune checkpoint inhibitor myocarditis. And those include complete heart block and cardiogenic shock. That's the first step. Second step is all patients should have their immune therapy temporarily held at least until the diagnosis is made. That's fairly easy because a lot of these patients get these infusions of immune checkpoint inhibitors every couple of weeks, so it's not like they're getting them every day. Typically, we advise these patients are admitted to a unit which has telemetry capabilities and has the ability to have backup pace. The fourth thing we advise, again, non-pharmacologically, is that it's a multidisciplinary approach involving their inpatient and outpatient cardiology teams to try and optimally manage the patient. Here at MGH, we have this thing called the Severe Immunotherapy Complications Group. And what that is, a centralized resource where patients on immune checkpoint inhibitors are admitted to an oncology-led service when they have these severe immunotherapy complications. And then they will consult the pulmonologist, they'll consult the hepatologist, they'll consult gastroenterologist, depending on what the main immune complication is. So those are the first couple of things: admission, telemetry, holding immune therapy, multidisciplinary approach. And then once you make the diagnosis, what's the first step in pharmacological management to these patients? And the first step is corticosteroids, and corticosteroids. there are several guidelines out there which all say one should treat these patients with corticosteroids. But the guidelines vary a little bit is what the optimal dose of corticosteroids should be for the initial management of these patients. And so I'm going to throw out a couple of names, like ASCO, American Society of Clinical Oncology, have a set of guidelines. SITC, Society of Sur Immunotherapy, has a set of guidelines. NCCN, National Cancer Network, has a set of guidelines. ESMO, European Society of Medical Oncology, has a set of guidelines. And most of them don't say exactly the same thing. Two of those guidelines, NCCN and SITC, say give a gram of solimedrol if you're concerned or if you have a diagnosis of immune checkpoint inhibitor myocarditis. ASCO, American Society of Clinical Oncology, says start with 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram of prednisone and escalate the dose of corticosteroids rapidly if there's no response. I can tell you here, we generally start every patient with myocarditis on 1 gram of solimedrol per day. And if there's a response to that gram of solimedrol, then we continue it for the next couple of days and then taper it to 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram of oral prednisone after a couple of days and continue to watch to make sure there's a response to corticosteroids. And that's our general initial approach to these management to these patients.
It definitely makes sense to treat these patients in specialized centers, as you talked about, Tom. And it sounds like corticosteroids are the cornerstone of treatment. However, are there any additional therapies that are recommended and what would trigger us to seek out and use these therapies?
I would say that there are other therapies which are reasonable to consider in patients who are either corticosteroid resistant or maybe even in sicker patients up front, think about combined initial immunosuppression. But the guidelines vary widely on what those second line agents should be for patients who break through on corticosteroids or for patients who may require more intensified immunosuppression upfront. And so what are the potential options? And the following is a select list. One can consider IVIG. One can consider Cellcept. One can consider ATG. One can consider alemtuzumab. One can consider abatacept. One could consider plasmapheresis. And finally, there are some data for JAK-STAT inhibitors. So all these are other potential therapies which could be used in patients who require additional immunosuppression on top of corticosteroids. I don't think we have any data to support any of them, and it's an area which urgently needs data. So I can give you our general approach here in that if a patient needs an additional immunosuppression and they're not responding to high-dose corticosteroids, we will generally add Cellcept. If the patient needs additional immunosuppression, but they're not well, so they've had an event, then the conversation turns to one of the following, either ATG, alemtuzumab, or abatacept. But we need more data. And small plug, but we're working on a clinical trial right now called the Atrium Trial. And in that Atrium trial, we're randomizing approximately 400 individuals throughout the United States and Canada to corticosteroids, i.e. a gram of solimedrol, or corticosteroids plus abatacept. And abatacept is given at randomization. Abatacept, our study drug, is given at randomization, again at 24 hours, again at day 14, and there's an optional fourth dose at day 28. But we need data like that to better understand what these patients' options are, because sadly, a lot of them break through in corticosteroids, number one. And then number two, a massive issue with corticosteroids is such high doses of corticosteroids may adversely impact cancer outcomes. And so we're very cognizant of the fact that in patients who get a gram of solimedrol, we may be winning the battle, i.e. treating the myocarditis, but we may be losing the war, i.e. their overall cancer care.
So far, we learned that patients with ICI-associated myocarditis can present very acutely and require prompt diagnosis and treatment and also a multidisciplinary approach. Tom, I'm curious, how prevalent is subclinical myocarditis and what is your approach in managing these patients who are incidentally diagnosed screening, and is it safe to continue their immunotherapy? Or do you typically need to start empiric steroids or empiric treatment for possible myocarditis?
That is a great but hard question to answer, Evelyn. So subclinical smoldering myocarditis is an under-recognized entity. So I'm going to give you a couple of scenarios and try and think that through. So we will often get referrals for patients, and the question will be, I have a patient on immunotherapy. They had a baseline troponin, which was undetectable. The patient is otherwise well, but for some reason, they had a troponin value drawn, a high sensitivity number, troponin T, maybe it's 30. And the question is, what does that mean and what do we do? So I don't know if that means they've got smoldering myocarditis. And what I'll often say to the provider who asked me the question, I will say, it's not clear to me that an individual has myocarditis. They can continue immunotherapy, but we should recheck to troponin in short order over a short period just to make sure it's not rising. Because if it is true blue myocarditis, that troponin will continue to rise. What are the other types of patients we often get referred or get questions on? So the smoldering myocarditis question is a little more difficult to answer in that we recognize that when you give immune checkpoint inhibitors, there is a normal response where the T cells will infiltrate into the organ because that's how they work. So there's a normal T cell infiltrate into every organ system when you give immune checkpoint inhibitors, and that includes the heart. And there was a nice study by Dr. Michel and colleagues in the European Heart Journal in 2021, where they did two studies in parallel, where they had a mouse model where they gave PD-1 inhibitors, and then they had patients with melanoma getting similar PD-1 inhibitors. And what they found was that there was a reduction in cardiac systolic function using global longitudinal strain. And in the mouse model, the reduction in global longitudinal strain was due to a T cell infiltrate into the myocardium with no myocarditis. And so those, it's a very confusing area. What does subclinical myocarditis mean? Is subclinical myocarditis actually just a normal T cell infiltrate into the myocardium, or is there actually true blue myocarditis, i.e. is there cell breakdown and cell death? If there's cell breakdown and cell death, then that's myocarditis and that's got to be treated with corticosteroids. If it's just a T cell infiltrated into the myocardium, maybe global longitudinal strain is a bit down, but the patient is fine otherwise, then that's probably not myocarditis. That is the immune checkpoint doing its job, and those patients likely can just get observed.
We've been hearing so much about the cardiotoxicities and all the side effects of ICIs, but I want to just point out these drugs are saving lives. From an oncological perspective, it seems like these cardiotoxicities are interfering with the regimen and the overall prognosis could be affected. And you mentioned, Tom, that there is some impact on cancer outcomes when we give patients corticosteroids or immunosuppressants. Do we have any data on the impact that having a cardiotoxicity or receiving corticosteroids can have on cancer outcomes? And even when a patient develops an ICI myocarditis or another side effect, can they have a second chance and be rechallenged with these saving ICI therapies?
Both good questions, Zell. And so there are good data, just not in the cardiology space, about the impact of high doses of corticosteroids on cancer outcomes. And so those data are, if you take a step back, when you give an immune checkpoint inhibitor, about 70% of patients will get an immune-related adverse event. But typically those immune-related adverse events are mild and easily managed. Only about 10 to 20% will get a severe immune-related adverse event. But the more common immune-related adverse events are things like colitis, things like pneumonitis, things like hepatitis. And so there's reasonable data from those cohorts who get those three entities about the impact of corticosteroids on cancer outcomes. And the data would suggest that even lower doses of corticosteroids, prednisone 20, 40 milligrams, can adversely affect cancer outcomes. And that's why we have to be sure we're making the correct diagnosis when there's a potential patient with these immune-related toxicities and be sure that corticosteroids are the right answer. The second question you asked was about rechallenge. And you know, that's one of the toughest questions I always get about immune checkpoint inhibitors and whom is it safe to rechallenge with these, as you said, potentially life-saving cancer therapies. And there are no data to support what I'm about to say, so this is just personal opinion. And I think the folks who I would consider rechallenging are individuals who have all of the following. So the all of the following is they originally got myocarditis on combination immune checkpoint inhibitors, and the next therapy is single agent therapy, number one. Number two is that their original myocarditis was relatively benign, so it wasn't the myocarditis associated with fulminant outcomes. Number three is their original myocarditis was completely treated, and so they're no longer on immunosuppression. Number four is that the patient and providers agree that there's a reasonable chance, so it's informed, that there's a reasonable chance of recurrence. And then number five is that the patient is willing to undergo serial surveillance for looking for recurrence of myocarditis. So those are the five things I generally think about when considering rechallenge. There are some data though to help us identify those individuals who may be safely rechallenged. And there's a nice publication from Dr. Nick Palaskas, 2020 or 21, in one of the European Heart Journal family of journals. And in that paper, he biopsied about 40 or so individuals with immune checkpoint inhibitor myocarditis. And what he found was that those individuals who had just had a T cell infiltrate into the myocardium with no myocyte breakdown could be safely continued on immune checkpoint inhibitors or safely rechallenged on immune checkpoint.
Let's now turn our attention and discuss immune checkpoint inhibitor related cardiotoxicities beyond myocarditis. Immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy can be linked with other conditions such as pericardial disease, conduction abnormalities, venous thrombosis, and vasculitis. Tom, would you mind telling us a little bit about how common these conditions are, since we definitely focused more on myocarditis? And are these conditions were occurring in the same time frame, the acute phase, or do these occur later on?
Great question. If we take a step back and think about the individual potential cardiac immune-related adverse events, there is likely an increase in all cardiac events which are driven by immune activation and inflammation among patients who receive immune checkpoint inhibitors. So if you break those out a little bit, there's a lovely paper from Dr. Jingyi Gong, who is a cardiology fellow here at MGH, where she found that there's a four-fold increase in the presence of pericarditis and pericardial effusions among patients who get immune checkpoint inhibitors, and also showed an increase in DVT and PE among patients who get an immune checkpoint inhibitor. Typically, those presentations for pericardial disease and pericardial effusions are early, whereas the presentations for DVT and PE tend to be a little bit later. Are there longer-term potential effects of immune checkpoint inhibitors on the cardiovascular system? And indeed, there possibly are. These immune checkpoints are also critical regulators of atherosclerosis. And there's a paper by Dr. Zsófi Drogbi from Semmelweis University in Hungary, where Dr. Drogbi looked at the rates of atherosclerotic cardiovascular events among patients getting immune checkpoint inhibitors and showed a threefold increase atherosclerosis-related cardiovascular events and a threefold increase in atherosclerosis in plaque progression among these patients. And there's a lot of biological plausibility to support that these same immune checkpoints that are being targeted for cancer are also critical regulators of atherosclerosis. And so in patients who have late-stage disease, it's probably not as important to consider later effects like atherosclerosis, plaque-related events. But it probably is important in patients with adjuvant and neoadjuvant care for whom the expected survival is thankfully measured in decades, that we may be accelerating atherosclerosis with these, with the currently FDA-approved immune checkpoint inhibitors. Now, I'm choosing my words very carefully because not all immune checkpoint inhibitors likely have the same effect on atherosclerosis. And so, for example, immune checkpoint inhibitors that target T cells, especially the ones that are FDA approved, likely increase atherosclerosis. But there are other immune checkpoints being leveraged to treat cancers, and one of them is a CD47 antagonist. So those CD47 antagonists have a key role in cancer and also in atherosclerosis, but in opposite direction to the immune checkpoints that target T cells. So targeting CD47 for cancer might actually reduce inflammation in the vasculature and might actually reduce atherosclerosis. And so there may be this paradigm where it depends on the immune checkpoint inhibitor you're talking about.
Well, just in time, our Nukes patient rolled in.
We're going to see now Mr. Neil Aldwib. He is a 70-year-old male. He has metastatic lung cancer. He was started in an ICI by his oncologist about 2 months ago. Now he's presenting today with acute chest pain. He said the chest pain was worse with exertion. He also was having some diaphoresis and nausea. His EKG showed evidence of an inferior STEMI, and he was emergently taken to the cath lab and was lucky enough to have Dan as the interventional fellow, who quickly performed an core angiogram and revealed acute occlusion of the right coronary artery and successfully underwent PCI on his expert hands. Given that mounting evidence that you're prescribing, Tom, of both for clinical studies and also Dr. Drobny's published clinical data showing an association between ICIs and a possible progression of atherosclerosis with some of these checkpoint inhibitors and maybe even coronary plaque disruption, could this patient's presentation of acute coronary syndrome be related to his ICI therapy? Can you tell us a little bit more about what we know about this implication with different atherosclerotic events?
I would say, Giselle, at this stage, you could probably tell me more, considering you just wrote a nice review on this exact topic. So we do think that some patients, especially adjuvant and neoadjuvant patients, will get accelerated atherosclerosis on immune checkpoint inhibitors. There are limited data, and this is an area of very active research. But I think what the data showed thus far is that the animal data are clear in that immune checkpoint inhibitors being targeted for cancer are key regulators of atherosclerosis biology. And targeting these immune checkpoints in animal studies leads to an increase in atherosclerosis. In the opposite, actually, it looks like abatacept, which is a CTLA-4 agonist in animal studies associated with reduction in atherosclerosis. And indeed, in rheumatoid arthritis patients, it looks like giving abatacept was associated with a reduction in atherosclerosis-related cardiovascular events. And so we're going to have to be a little more mindful that as patients, especially earlier stage patients, adjuvant, new adjuvant patients, get these therapies, that there is a potential for accelerated atherosclerosis. But the management would be very different. So if a patient's on immunotherapy and they come in with a myocardial infarction that's related to plaque rupture, we typically don't give those patients corticosteroids. Actually, we don't give those patients corticosteroids, and we don't hold immunotherapy. We just need to better understand what's driving the plaques in those patients and think about a targeted therapy that might help those individuals.
Tom, thank you so much for that. And Giselle, wow, we are super excited to read your paper. Congratulations. Going back to you, Tom, is there any role for therapies to prevent the progression of atherosclerosis associated with immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy?
Oh, fabulous question. So again, Dr. Drugby looked at this because two factors she found were associated with less plaque progression. Factor number one was corticosteroids. So those individuals on corticosteroids had less plaque progression, which kind of makes it biologically all plausible. However, you're not going to give these individuals corticosteroids because it's going to adversely impact cancer outcomes. The second thing, which looks like it slowed but didn't completely reduce plaque progression, was statins. And so individuals on statins had less plaque progression than those individuals who are not on statins. But the challenge with that data is that the statin use in immune checkpoints is associated with higher rates of CK elevation and higher rates of myositis. And that's a relatively feared complication among patients on immune checkpoint inhibitors. We actually don't have a good biological intervention right now to target atherosclerosis. And we just need better research to understand what drives atherosclerosis in these populations. And that research, there are a lot of potentials out there. So what are the potentials that might slow plaque progression? There's an elegant paper in Nature Medicine where a group in Southeast Asia looked at PCSK9 inhibition. And they looked at PCSK9 inhibition to see if it could improve the efficacy of immune checkpoint inhibitors on cancer cell death. So could PCSK9 inhibition on top of immune checkpoint inhibitors in various animal cell lines increase the responsiveness to immune checkpoint inhibitors? And the answer was yes. Of course, the study I'm now thinking about is whether giving PCSK9 inhibitors to patients on immune checkpoints is associated with better cancer outcomes and better vascular outcomes. That's number one. Number two is there are studies out there like CANTOS, where groups targeted inflammation. CANTOS, they targeted with canakinumab, IL-1 beta. And in CANTOS, There was a reduction in atherosclerotic cardiovascular events and a reduction in incident lung cancer events. So there's the potential to think about IL-1 beta inhibition in this population. But in reality, we're flying a little blind and we need more research to better understand what's driving the plaque here.
Wow, this is such an exciting area and we learned so much today so far about ICI-related cardiotoxicity. So let's next shift our focus to our last case for the day. So I have Mr. Kim Eric here, who is a 60-year-old male with relapsed large B-cell lymphoma, who was started on CAR T-cell therapy or CD19 targeting chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy. And now he developed persistent atrial fibrillation and had high-grade cytokine release syndrome or CRS. Tom, can you tell us more about home manifestations of cardiotoxicity associated with CAR T-cell therapy?
Yes, this is equally as interesting an area of investigation. And I think what the investigations thus far have shown is there are about 20 to 30 patients who get CAR T-cell therapy who have a cardiovascular event. Now, what is that cardiovascular event? It could typically be their arrhythmias, supraventricular tachycardia, atrial fibrillation, atrial flutter, occasionally ventricular tachycardia, hypotension, typically the hypotension due to capillary leak syndrome, the development of a cardiomyopathy, so reduction in left ventricular ejection fraction and clinical heart failure, cardiogenic shock in some individuals. So roughly about 20 to 30% of patients who get CAR T-cell therapy will have a cardiovascular event. Who are those individuals who do have a cardiovascular event after CAR T-cell therapy? And they're generally patients with pre-existing cardiovascular disease, number one. They're also patients who have a higher burden of disease, number two. And the third thing is, it's generally patients who get this cytokine release syndrome. And CRS or cytokine release syndrome became really famous during COVID. But cytokine release syndrome is a common occurrence among patients who get CAR T-cell therapy. It typically occurs about 5 to 6 days in. Fevers, tachycardia, hypotension, non-fluid responsive. And those are the folks, especially folks with higher grades of cytokine release syndrome or CRS, are the individuals who tend to get cardiac-related complications from CAR T-cell therapy.
Tom, and is there a relationship between the severity of the cytokine release syndrome and your risk of developing cardiotoxicity due to CAR T-cell therapy?
Absolutely, Giselle. And this higher the grade of cytokine release syndrome, the higher the likelihood of having a cardiac event and more severe cardiac event. And the occurrence of a cardiac event in the setting of CAR T-cell therapy is associated with worse outcomes. And so it's important to understand who gets it. And we think the people who get it are more likely people who get pre-existing cardiovascular disease and more bulky cancer disease and people who get cytokine release syndrome. So the next question is, well, what can you do about it? Are there any approaches you can think about as a reduction in the potential for individuals to have cardiac events on CAR T-cell therapy? And we think there are. We think that patients who have pre-existing cardiovascular disease should probably see the cardio-oncology doctor prior to getting CAR T-cell therapy. We think that most of these individuals should have an echocardiogram, should have a baseline EKG, troponin, NT-proBNP. They should have optimization of cardiovascular risk factors. And then during or after administration of CAR T-cell therapy, they should be closely observed for the development of cytokine release. And patients at very high risk of developing CAR T-cell associated cardiovascular events, we should probably think about earlier institution of anti-CRS therapies. And what do I mean by anti-CRS therapies? Well, the most commonly used anti-CRS therapy is tocilizumab, anti-IL-6. And there are good data to suggest that earlier initiation of tocilizumab in patients with cytokine release syndrome is associated with reduction in cardiovascular events. And so that's generally what we advocate for, close surveillance. If somebody's at high risk, earlier initiation of tocilizumab with the idea of minimizing this CRS effect on the heart.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us today to discuss immunotherapy-related cardiotoxicities. We learned so much from you, and it's such an exciting field, and there's so much that we still don't know yet, and I'm looking forward to see what we find out in the near future. So before we end the episode, I have one final question for you, Tom. What makes your heart flutter about cardio-oncology?
I think it's kind of a humbling subspecialty within cardiology. And what I say is we're certainly at the early stages of understanding most of the toxicities and how they relate to certainly immune therapies. The other thing that's kind of humbling and it's kind of interesting is the world of cancer biology changes on such a rapid basis. New therapies are being introduced all the time. And with these new therapies, there's the potential for many of them to have cardiovascular effects. And so our understanding is continuously evolving. And so this is a field where there's continuous growth, where there's continuous opportunity to learn and to improve. And that's kind of what makes the heart flutter when I think about cardio-oncology.
What an incredible episode. Thank you again, Tom, for sharing so many practical points on this important topic. I'm sure cardio nerds everywhere are now much more informed on how to diagnose and manage these patients. We also hope that cardio nerds continue to learn and be excited about cardio-oncology with this cardio-oncology series. We look forward to continue with this amazing series, so stay tuned.
Thanks for tuning into another cardio nerds episode. The audio editing for this episode was performed by me, Maryam Barkordarian. I'm a Cardio Nurse Academy Fellow in House Tosic and the resident at Hackensack Meridian Health. Check out the episode page for show notes and references. If you found this episode or the show informative, please consider subscribing to Cardio Nurse on your favorite podcast platform and leaving us a review. It really helps us spread the word and further our goal to democratize cardiovascular education. Finally, this podcast is not meant to be used for medical advice. The view expressed on our show and site do not reflect the opinions or policies of our employers. All Card Nerds content is planned, produced, and reviewed solely by Card Nerds. Stay tuned for more engaging conversation and exploration in our upcoming episodes. And now it's time to make like an S2N split.